طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. In the city of Nablus in the West Bank of Palestine, a linguistic professor by the name of Mohammed Salwaha founded a project following the signing of the Oslo Accords to prepare the Palestinian people for the democratic state they thought was promised by the Accords. Although the democratic state never came, the project called the Palestinian House of Friendship has flourished with a broadened mission and a new purpose. Mohammed Salwaha spoke at a fundraiser for the project in Cambridge a few weeks ago, and his speech is the focus of our first presentation this morning. Here is Mohammed Salwaha, director of the Palestinian House of Friendship.
Good evening, and it's my honor to be with you to talk really about two things, and to talk about the situation in Palestine, and to talk about also about the Palestinian House of Friendship under occupation, and how certain organizations similar to my organization could survive, could work under such circumstances. Usually when I start talking about Palestine, sometimes I don't know from where to start, but in this visit to the United States, I don't know why it came to my mind this time that I have been living under the occupation for 50 years, and that is since 1967. And that at that time, my age was 13, so I was at that time within the international standards. I was a child at that time. Then it came to my mind when those days when the Israeli tanks just came into the West Bank and came into my village. And what were my priorities at that time? I was just only with my mother. My father was in Saudi Arabia with my sister, and other brothers were working outside. So we found ourselves, I and my mother and another sister, just there when the occupation happened, when the curfew happened. And what was, I was just walking with a friend of mine also in the Central Park in New York, and that friend, she asked me, what were your main concerns when you came to know that your village and the West Bank is under occupation? I told her the first two things that came to my mind is, first of all right, it's just what shall we do? I and my mother and my sister, aren't we going really to see our father and other sisters and other brothers? Because we are four brothers and four sisters, but most of them were outside. And the other two things that also I was worried about is that I was taking care at that time of a fish. And it was in just a jar of water, and I used to take care of just replacing the water. And the people at that time came to say that if you want to be safe, you need to go to the basement. And unfortunately, the fish was on the first floor. So I was, in my opinion, I was really gambling my life, just going from the basement to the first floor in order just to save the life of the fish. And another thing, that I was also collecting money and putting them in a small box. So also I was very much afraid that the Israelis will come to the house and take my money. So I kept them always what with my under my shoulder. So that was very childish, and that was, I think, very justified for every child. But after that, I thought that really I spent those 50 years, and those in those 50 years, I finished my higher studies. Then I went to Birzeit University. I ran for the elections of the Students' Council. We were only about seven Muslim students in a Christian university of more than 400 students at that time. And most of the people just told me, "Are you crazy to run for the Students' Council?" I told them, "Okay, let's try and see." And I got elected as a member of the Students' Council there, and that gave me, you know, a certain power into just, yes, there is life, and that you can know more, and you can lead, and you can make a certain change. Okay, I'm not going to talk about so much about that, but just also I wanted to say that the Palestinian people and the Palestinian land went through different, let's say, social, political changes. I still remember also when the first municipal election happened in the in the West Bank and Gaza, and some nationalist Palestinian mayors at that time, they won the elections. And after that, of course, they were not accepted by the Israeli military authorities. Three of them, and was one of them was the mayor of Nablus, Bassam Shak'a, and the other one, the mayor of Ramallah, Karim Khalaf, also they have been, or there was an attempt to assassinate them. Bassam Shak'a lost two of his legs from an organization they called themselves at that time TNT, and Karim Khalaf also, he was badly hurt and he died, and all of these things. So those things started really to open our minds about what's going on. You see that that of course led to the first intifada. But okay, and here I want really to come and to make a kind of just talking about how the idea of the Palestinian House of Friendship really came to our mind. It came to our mind believing that the Palestinians, they deserve really to run a peaceful civil life, and for that sake, we thought that we have to do something in Palestine. That was really also coinciding with certain attempts from the two peoples, and here I mean the Palestinians and the Israelis, on how can we help in bringing this occupation to an end. So we thought that there must be a joint effort, not only from the Palestinian, we were under the occupation, but also from the Israelis, because there were some good voices just supporting the Palestinian rights, and they are within the Israeli peace camp. We met together, we went to each other's homes, and we planned how can we work together, and that took us, I can say, 2, 3, 4 years. And we demonstrated together, urging the leaders on both sides, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, and the government of Israel at that time, into that time is now to make peace in the Middle East, and let's try to finish the bloodshed and all of these things. The losers are the people of the on two sides, and no one is getting benefit from that. So let's come to that point. As I said, we demonstrated, and we were lucky at that time that, of course, it was at the same time of the negotiations between the Palestinians and Israel in Madrid and here in Washington, but also that the real agreement or the final agreement, it was in Oslo. So there was some kind of negotiation, all right, in secret, as I want to say, in Oslo, and that led to the Oslo agreement. All right. We thought that any agreement that could bring the bloodshed into an end, the conflict into an end, and having two states for two peoples, both of them are free, both of them are secure, we are supporting that. So because of that, the Palestinians, despite all the weaknesses that we have seen in the, or we saw in the Oslo agreement, we supported that. We said, okay, let's do it step by step. Let's have it step by step, because peace deserves at least people just to wait, and if we can reach a good and peaceful conclusion. And for that, people took this to the streets, because one of the terms of the of Oslo is that the Israelis should pull from the Palestinian land, and that was, let's now pull from the cities. And really, it was a very great move when we started to see that the Israelis started to move from the Palestinian cities. I was in Nablus, and when we saw that the other day, the Israelis were not in the city of Nablus, the whole people, they were very happy. And the first place I wanted to visit is a prison that was in Nablus, or that is in Nablus. I spent about 50 days in one of its cells in a solitary confinement. So I took my sons with me, and we went there, and I told them, here, where I was. I was very happy, and I just wanted my children at that time really to feel happy that such a thing that's not going to happen to them as it happened to their father. And I think, you know, I'm talking about myself, because I think also it was the same feeling for most of the Palestinians. But what happened after that? And before I say, you know, what happened after that, for that reason, we in the Palestinian House of Friendship, we conducted tens of workshops and activities and lectures for the sake of preparing our people for the coming state, for the possibility of choosing our representatives in the coming parliament. And this is what we did. And we did it really from the heart. We haven't had any training on that level, because we haven't had any election before. But from our inside, we thought that we can determine what is good and what is bad, and what is transparent and what is not transparent in the elections. And the most important thing, how can we reach the people and tell them whom you are going to choose today is going to determine your future, to determine your, yes, future. So that was the whole concept of the end of the negotiation. But after that, people started really to find that this is not the story, and this is not the picture. And it seems that, all right, the people, they are, of course, very emotional and very sensitive. Okay, peace is coming. And peace is coming for us. It means that, okay, we are not going to see checkpoints. We are not going to see soldiers. Even we are not going to see the aeroplanes, the jets, just hovering around above us. That is the peace that we wanted to see. That we can go to any place from Nablus to Ramallah to Jerusalem to pray there. That's going really to be open. But That was not the case. People started to discover that what happened is that the division of the geography of the West Bank into those areas that we call A, B, and C. So the people in the in the West Bank, as if they are divided really into three categories. People who are living in Area A, where the Palestinian Authority, and you can see the Palestinian police there with their guns and so on, in order to determine security and safety of people. And you can go to Area B, all right, you can finish your any administrative work with the Palestinians, but the Israelis are there with their military. And if you go a little bit beyond that boundary of B, you go into Area C, and that is about 63% of the Palestinian land completely under the Israeli occupation. So everyone, and I am one of them, started really to feel that I am divided even in my personality. I don't have that independence. I don't have that safety. I cannot determine. I am just surrounded. I am enclosed. I am in another prison. Yes, maybe it's not 2 by 2 meters as the one that I was in Nablus prison, but it is now, it is a little bit wider, maybe 5 kilometers by 5 kilometers. But if I go after that and I don't have my ID with me, I could be stopped by an Israeli military checkpoint and I can be humiliated or taken or whatever like that. All right, so the idea here is that people really, they did not find the peace that they wanted. Settlements were very few in number. We started to see that they are expanded and they are increased also in number. The number of checkpoints, it started to cut all the Palestinian cities. The water, everything is now being taken from the Palestinians. The demolishing of houses also, it became a general phenomenon. So the Palestinians really thought that this is not the peace that they wanted, and that led to the Second Intifada. And in the Second Intifada, the Israelis came back to the cities. They came back and they destroyed the infrastructure that was built at the time of the Palestinian Authority, and that was built by the European donations, the American donations, the Japanese donations, that was given at that time as, yes, let's give the Palestinians a certain chance to build their country, to have a certain infrastructure, but that was completely damaged and destroyed. All right, so we thought in our organization, maybe it's not now the time for just making civic education or so, and that is really very important, but the most important thing is now to take care of our children. So we shifted mainly, and we did not leave the civic education part. We concentrated on how can we take care of our children. And I still remember, and I mentioned it, and I reiterated, and I will keep reiterating it, that the first summer camp that we called Smiling Faces, we did it under a curfew, when Nablus was under a curfew. We did it in one of the basements of some of the buildings. We gathered about 63 kids, of course, by coordinating with their families, with the moms, with the fathers. All right, so we just said, okay, the kids are suffering. The kids are under great pressures. So let's take an action. So we gathered them, and we asked some volunteers from among the young boys, young girls, just to go and to spend time with them, to try to help them to release all the frustration and the pressure that was built inside them through within 14 consecutive days of curfew. And you would not imagine what does it mean if you keep yourself and you keep the kids also with you for about 14 days, you are not able, or you are not able just to go outside. But we did a very good job there. We involved them in different activities like painting, like music, like dabka, the Palestinian dabka, the Palestinian dance. And when it happens that a merkava, and the merkava, it is a name of an Israeli huge tank, and when it comes in any neighborhood, it shakes it completely. So when it comes and passes by that building, the children just keep silent until it passes away. And when it leaves, they started what just to shout. I don't know what they shout, scream, but the volunteers encouraged them to do that. Whether that was just to show that they are happy that no danger is around, or just maybe a victorious sound that, okay, we are here despite what is going outside. We involved also our community with what we call the popular education. Because I said, when the Israelis came, they just closed the schools, closed the universities. So we took also the initiative on that level. Why on that level? Because as I said, that this is now our philosophy in the Palestinian House of Friendship. And this is what we are working on, in trying really to invest in this young, in the younger generation, in the children. We cannot claim, maybe as Palestinians, or I don't know whether the Arabs, I'm not going to talk about them, but I'm not going to talk, I'm talking about Palestinians. We cannot claim that we can defeat the Israelis within the military bases. They are so powerful. They have everything. We don't have their power. So we are not going really to go into that path. Are they going to stay, for example, in our land? Are they going to confiscate more? Okay, the land is going to stay. It was before the BC, the same land. It's going to be the same land. And in the future, we do believe that it will come at a certain time where we, the Palestinians, will stay in the same land. So maybe it's not now. But what we are afraid is about the coming generation, about the culture, about the good things, about the beliefs in staying in the land. So this is why we think that working with kids, telling them about their history, teaching them about their folklore, teaching them about how to love, how not to hate, and to believe in their land is the most important thing. And this is what we have been doing from that time until now. For that sake, I'm not going just to keep you listening to me, but for that sake, since that time, we have been doing these summer camps. We started, as I said, with 62. Last year, we have in the summer camps about 300. Mm-hmm. This year, we are expecting about 400. We are going to run about 3 summer camps in the city and the surrounding villages. As I said, what do we involve them? We involve them in certain activities that we want them to live their childhood, to feel that they are children. I have in my back here, in the back of my mind, all right, we want them really to grow faster in order just to be in a real conflict with their suppressors or oppressors. No. All right, we want to build them spiritually. We want to build them culturally. We want to build them also physically. Physically also, we, the Palestinian House of Friendship, has established in cooperation with some international organizations, a Scottish organization, they call them Skate Pal. We built a skate park in the nearby, it is in Asira, it is in a nearby village of the city of Nablus. And the goal from that is just to give these kids also an opportunity. First of all, just to acquaint and to know that there are certain new sports and they يعني كان involved in, and even for me it was completely new, and also just to let them also spend some of their time away from the pressures that usually they live in, either in the school, because we know that schools, they are just dictating. They go to the home and the father and the mother kept also dictating on them to do all these things. So we think that, yes, let's open a new thing for them, to express themselves, to build their bodies, to build their mentality and whatever. For this sake, we work now with international volunteers who are now for the second year are staying in the village where we have the skate park. Their mission is to train our children, and for that sake, and in order to give them really a great hope, we raised a slogan in that small village, and that slogan is "From Asira," the name of the village, to Tokyo. From Asira to Tokyo. Why is this? It is like this: the Olympic Committee took a decision in the last in one of its meetings that it's going to consider skateboarding as a sport, as a formal sport. So we thought, we have a skate park, we have the kids, boys and girls, we have volunteers who are coming, and more, and some of them, they are on international standards, and the skate park with international standards. We can send a team from Asira to participate in the Olympic Games. And what we want from that, just to tell them that everything is possible. And this also to teach the surrounding and the other kids, that always, if you invest in something, you will cultivate it. And this is what we are now planning. We are now preparing everything. And I have some of good philanthropists here. And one of them is your father. Yes, Dean Saikon, who said that when you finish of that, I'm going to sponsor anything related to this theme to go to Tokyo. So thanks very much. By doing this, we are trying really to give an example that under the occupation, people also cannot be defeated. And they can do, and they can be productive. I want to talk about, in addition to having scouts and all of these things, I want to talk about also a very ambitious project, and that is starting a music studio. We are going to build a studio, and also Alia came to our center last year, and we are hoping that the instruments, I was today with the people of Manchester in the UK who are going to donate also the instruments to Palestinian House of Friendship. So we hope that everything will go according to the plan, and we hope that the Israelis will not stop the shipment and let the instruments to come to Palestine. The idea also from that is just to give the kids an opportunity to record their music, to record their songs. In addition to that, we are, as I said, we are very much concerned of our culture. One of the major ideas also that we are going to do in this music studio is to record the Palestinian oral history. Again, we are being fought also on this level. we are being fought on the level of our heritage, on the level of our culture, on the level of our food, on the level of our air, on the level of the environment. This is what we are now subjected to. Because of that, they built the wall between the two peoples in order not just to come together. And that environmentally, socially, it divided many Palestinian families on the two sides. And here again, I am going at all of my gratitude and thankful also to two figures, philanthropist figures, again, Dean Saikon and Maria Riklicki, also from New York, who are just giving us, who are supporting the Palestinian House of Friendship, and who are donating in order to make this project come into an existence. My presence, my trips to everywhere, either here or outside, it is just really to generate all kinds of resources, either in terms of money, either in terms of instruments, either in terms of internship, either on any level. We in the Palestinian House of Friendship, we are trying to do our best, really, to give hope and to give, a kind of hope to the kids that there is a future in front of them. So the last word that I want just to say is that we are not, or we hope that all the walls of hatred will come down, will be destroyed, and with what we are doing, we hope that to build bridges in the Middle East for the sake of the all children in the Middle East and in the world. Thank you very much for listening to me, and this is really the message of the Palestinian House of Friendship. Thank you very much.
That was Mohammed Salwaha, director of the Palestinian House of Friendship, speaking at the First Parish Church, Cambridge. Our next presentation is an interview with Columbia University historian Rashid Khalidi, conducted by Nader Hashemi, political scientist at the University of Denver, concerning the Palestinian political leadership. Where is it? How has it succeeded or failed? Where is it going? Questions about the leadership we are all asking these days. Here is Rashid Khalidi on the Palestinian leadership crisis.
Okay, Rashid, first of all, welcome to the Center for Middle East Studies. I want to sort of shift the conversation from the discussions and debates you've been having since you arrived here and focus on a topic of which you are, in many ways, the leading global expert on. Mm-hmm. And that's the question of Palestinian nationalism, in particular, Palestinian leadership.
Right.
And one of the, I think, tragedies of the Palestinian national movement and the Palestinian people's struggle for national self-determination, in my view, has been the colossal failure of an effective leadership to represent them, to push forward their democratic and national agenda. And so, you know, there's a question here that needs to be answered. And of course, it can't be done in a few minutes, but I want to just pick your brain a bit and ask you the first question. What went wrong? Okay. How did a movement, how did a cause that was very popular throughout the Arab Islamic world, with the Third World, end up where we are today?
Right.
And how would you sort of explain, just in broad terms, how this leadership ended up really, you know, failing in such a colossal manner?
Right. Well, I actually wrote a book called The Iron Cage, in which I tried to set out my understanding of this problem in a very long perspective, going back to the beginning of the 20th century and focusing especially on the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and explaining, trying to explain why there were leadership failures in that era, and then showing how the next generation of leadership, which emerged in the 40s and 50s and was responsible for the renaissance of the Palestinian national movement from the 60s onwards, differed from the previous leadership in class and in educational and in aspirational terms. And I tried to be fair to them because they were extraordinarily successful in both reunifying Palestinian ranks, creating a relatively unified national movement, appealing to Palestinian, Arab, Muslim, and world audiences, from the 60s through the 80s. But this is where the problems emerge. Firstly, this leadership was subject to a relentless campaign of assassinations. And I have to say that most of the best of that generation, who by now actually are quite long in the tooth in any case, but most of the best of that generation were eliminated systematically one by one, most of them by Israeli efforts, but some of them by the efforts of Arab governments. I mean, a large number of them were killed by groups that were manipulated by either Syrian or Libyan or Iraqi intelligence services. And I think that at a certain point, they lost touch with their mass base, especially after the departure from Beirut of the PLO leadership. They were in Tunis and in Yemen, in places very far away from concentrations of Palestinian population. They were dependent on a diplomatic strategy that was in many ways faulty. They had more or less given up the idea of putting pressure on Israel through armed struggle, which had not succeeded very well in any case. And brilliant analysts like Akbar Ahmed had told the PLO leadership that this was not going to work, and they had not been willing to listen. But in any case, it had more or less ceased to be a major element of their strategy. And when the First Intifada came along, it was a manna from heaven for them. The First Intifada was the first significant Palestinian strategic victory, I would argue, in the whole course of Palestinian struggle.
Right.
You could say that to some extent that the successes of the PLO in establishing a new representative of the Palestinians was another important success in the 60s and 70s. But perhaps even more important than that was that the Intifada showed the world what occupation was like, showed the Israelis that the status quo could not continue. But unfortunately, that victory was frittered away in the negotiations of the 90s and the early 2000s. And that's where I think this leadership has really failed.
To what extent really here's the problem is the individual character of Arafat and his closest advisors. I mean, to what extent can we sort of, you know, focus on the failure of leadership, on the individual of Arafat himself and the decisions that he made that has led us to where we are today?
You know, I would make an argument that this is a broader problem than just the Mufti in the 30s or just Arafat in the 80s, or any individual. I think that you have a style of leadership in much of the Arab world, the Zaim, the single leader style. Arafat was part of a much more collegial leadership than a lot of these countries have had, but he was first among equals. And that style is one problem. A second problem is being distant from the people and not having to defend yourself in front of a representative assembly. And over time, the PLO became less and less representative, less and less of a live, functioning, organically sound body. And it's a shell now. So I think Arafat, personally, you can describe a lot of these problems as functions of his personality. Mm-hmm. But I think an overstress on the individual personality of this or that leader is probably a mistake. I fault him a great deal in that book, The Iron Cage. Him personally. I fault the Mufti a great deal personally. But I think these are broader structural issues. And I think that being in a situation where you're cut off, in particular, from that majority of Palestinians who live outside of Palestine, was a devastating blow from 82 onwards.
But this is not unique to the Palestinian National Movement. The ANC were cut off from their own society, but they were able to organize it very effective.
True.
So how does one explain the difference?
And Kurdish national movements.
And Kurdish national movements.
Have been, in some cases,
and
cut off.
And East Timorese, there's many others.
Right.
I think there's a deeper sort of set of problems here.
Right, I think you're probably
diagnosed.
You're probably right.
Well, let me push you a bit on that. I had an interview
ahead.
With the late Israel Shahak on this before he passed away. And he said one of the problems that resulted in the corruption and failure of the PLO was that there was just too much money. They had access to, that bred corruption, and it was a byproduct of the Arab state system, the Arab League, buying off people, and that led to a certain lack of democratic accountability. And if you contrast that with other national liberation movements, they had to be much more efficient. They didn't have those resources.
Right.
To what extent do you buy into that argument?
Well, that was already a problem in Beirut before 1982. Mm-hmm. And it was a problem partly because Arafat used money and perks and so on and so forth, and patronage as a means of buying loyalty. Mm-hmm. But the PLO in Beirut was in a situation of war. And so those phenomena, right, even though they were harmful, were not the primary phenomena. I mean, you basically had to provide food, or you basically had to provide fuel, right, or you basically had to have ammunition,
right,
or you basically had to have some kind of security and some kind of governance. And those overwhelmingly imperative tasks in a situation of war, I mean, we're talking about war in Lebanon from 73,
right,
really, when the Lebanese army,
right,
attacks the camps first,
right,
until 1982,
right,
meant that these phenomena were not as important as they became. But that period of complete idleness in Tunis or Yemen or wherever, from 82 until they returned in the mid-90s, was catastrophic.
Uh-huh.
It destroyed the PLO, uh-huh, in my view. It destroyed it as a functioning organization. The people who came back were hollow shells.
Yeah.
And when they arrived in the West Bank and Gaza, they shocked people,
yeah,
by their emptiness, by their hollowness,
right,
by their lack of any kind of apparent commitment to,
right,
the cause.
Right.
They expected now to be received like heroes, to achieve status, and not have to do anything,
right,
in return. They felt that they had won.
Right.
Here we are, we're back, we're going to govern you, we deserve this, and so on and so on. So this is more than, this is worse and deeper than just corruption.
Right.
When you then add to that the lavish funding that came in terms of taxes that Israel, or customs duties that Israel allowed to the Palestinian Authority, which were Palestinian revenues that should have been for the Palestinians anyway, and European, Arab, Japanese, and American funding that came to the PA,
mm-hmm,
it just became a thoroughly unhealthy situation.
Right.
Already you had patronage. Already you had corrupt means being employed. But the system simply was incapable of retaining any kind of integrity.
Right.
And when the system was somewhat rectified in the last decade or so, all that meant was, in a sense, corruption was regularized, corruption was institutionalized, and these kinds of perks. I mean, drive around Ramallah. You think you're in Amman.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a liberated country. This,
mm-hmm,
is not even a, this is not a nation state.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a sovereign entity. This is not the capital of anything.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like a vast, booming, it's a green zone,
mm-hmm,
with buildings going up,
mm-hmm,
and fancy offices and expensive cars and restaurants where people spend fortunes.
Right.
This is a very unhealthy situation.
Okay, this leads to the next question. Given the failures and the colossal disaster of the past, the question now is, what about the future?
Mm-hmm.
I think most people would agree, at least most Palestinians, I think, will agree that the current leadership under Abu Mazen and his gang have been equally as bad as the previous leadership under
worse.
Arafat.
Worse.
Okay.
Oh, worse. I mean, look, the Arafat leadership, in my view, messed up.
Right.
Systematically. And you can go back, talk about the 70s, or you can talk about the 80s. You certainly,
right,
can talk about the 90s.
Right.
But they at least had some achievements,
right,
to their credit.
Okay.
I mean, they created the PLO.
Right. So
they,
now
they put the Palestinians on the map.
It's gotten worse now.
They got, yeah, the Palestinians recognized.
Right.
They survived Lebanon. I mean, these are not inconsiderable achievements.
Absolutely.
You're not talking about a struggle where the Palestinians were equal to the Israelis, and yet the PLO managed to survive. So for all their failures, their failures of strategy and their excesses and so on and so forth after they returned to Palestine, that was a generation which could claim some things to their credit. I think that since the 90s onwards, it's been a catalog of catastrophes and disasters for the Palestinians, which this leadership bears a huge share of the responsibility for, without any, in my view, any countervening benefits that they've provided. The good things that have happened, that the Palestinian Authority has done, have been essentially the work of Palestinians from the occupied territories,
right,
creating structures that were already there under occupation,
right,
and developing them.
Right.
And it's been civil society rather than the state that's done the best things.
Right. So this leads to the big question, what about the future, and why aren't Palestinian intellectuals like yourself saying, look, enough is enough. We need to chart a different path. We need a 180-degree turn. This current leadership does not represent us. It doesn't represent the West Bank or Gaza. It certainly doesn't represent the Palestinian diaspora. We need a completely new vision for Palestinian nationalism. We will thank the leaders of the past. We're moving in a completely different direction. a new charter, a new assembly, a new vision to model a serious and credible Palestinian leadership on the model of what the ANC did and what other successful national liberations. Why isn't that happening now? It seems to be crying out for an answer, but I see no movement moving in that direction.
I attend conferences and meetings and so on in Palestine. I was there in September, a month ago. And one of the striking things is the degree to which the tone has changed in these kinds of meetings of the kind of people you're talking about, in terms of an increasingly critical and future-oriented critique of all of these things that we've just been talking about, an attempt to lay out a path towards the future. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, I am not personally a believer in the idea that intellectuals lead political movements. Intellectuals sometimes lay down some paths that movements follow. You know, people like Mahmoud Darwish, people like Edward Said, played a role. But the person who pushed some of the projects that they were engaged in was actually either Yasser Arafat or Salah Khalaf Abu Iyad. The guy who won the PNC over by his speeches was not Edward or Ibrahim Abu Ghud or Iqbal Ahmed or Mahmoud.
Right.
These incredibly important intellectuals who were pioneers in all kinds of spheres, including the political.
Right.
It was bruisers who are able to do politics in a way that no intellectual I've ever met has been able to do, who push things through. And that is what is lacking, in my view, in Palestine.
Right.
I know literally scores of Palestinian intellectuals, literally scores, some in the diaspora, some in Palestine, some in the Arab countries, the far diaspora of the Arab countries in Palestine, who have the analysis that you and I are talking about, and more, and better.
Yeah.
And they know it better than I do. I'm living in New York,
right,
for heaven's sakes. But what we really lack are a political leadership that's able to translate that into actual new tactics.
Right.
The Palestinians lack several things. They have to have a reunified national movement.
Right.
They have to have a consensus on how they want to approach the situation. How are we going to deal with this status quo?
Right.
How do we change it? Do we focus on occupation?
Right.
Do we focus on integration within Israel? How do we deal with an international consensus which accepts the absolute legitimacy of an Israeli state, which, as defined in the 1947 partition resolution, is a Jewish state, not the Jewish state that Netanyahu is talking about, but nevertheless, that's the language. How do you transcend that? I mean, there are so many questions that are not just intellectual questions.
Right.
There are questions that have to be turned into something that ordinary people can understand and mobilize around. And I'm really sorry. I know a lot of intellectuals. I know very few of them who are able to mobilize people around. They can put forward the ideas, but that has to be part of it.
Well, that's what I'm asking. The ideas aren't even out there on the table.
Oh, yes, they are.
Claiming or putting together
the conference I was at.
So they're there, they're circulating.
In Ramallah,
in
September.
These conversations were taking place?
Was 20 years after Oslo.
Right.
And many of these ideas I'm talking about are not my ideas.
Right.
They're things that other people were saying in the course of 2 days.
So what has to happen in order to materialize them, concretize them, make them move
in
the direction?
I think circumstances have to change.
Yeah.
And they may change, you know. Nobody expected the 1936 revolt to start when it did. This was an event that the leadership and intellectuals were completely surprised by. Now, people who had watched Sheikh Izzeddin Qassem's funeral, like various intellectual observers in 1935, said, oh my God, there's a popular movement brewing here that's going to lead to something. And it did. It erupted in 1936. And it was led partly by intellectuals, partly by political activists, mainly young people, in rebellion against the then political leadership. The same thing happened with the Fatah's launching and the PFLP's similar moves in the mid-60s. These were people, some of whom, few of whom were intellectuals or school teachers or whatever, but others of whom were just political activists and who launched this. Nobody was expecting it. And I would say the same thing about the First Intifada. And so I'm not saying that it doesn't need necessarily an uprising, but you have to have a start which has to come from the political situation, from people, not from intellectuals, I think, for those ideas then to fertilize a movement. That's what happened in the First Intifada, by the way.
But don't you need to have, as a sort of a precondition, a clear statement by someone that, look, this peace process is not of our interest.
Where was the clear statement in 1936? The strike started, and they issued an appeal.
Yeah.
It was in the wake of a strike, which sort of was spontaneous.
Yeah, but there's no peace process then. Now everyone's waiting to see what happens in these negotiations.
No.
We all know they're not going to lead anywhere positive.
No, people are not waiting for the... Okay. I mean, some people are. Yeah. But the kind of people we're talking about are not waiting. Right. I mean, if you look at what's happening in refugee camps today, there in the West Bank, there is clear dissatisfaction brewing with the PA. Now, the PA has, the Palestinian Authority, has unlimited capacities to subvert, to co-opt, to buy, to use patronage to neutralize, especially stuff in the camps, because the situation is so terrible in Jenin or in Balata or in Dehesha or any of these.
Say nothing about the Lebanese camps.
It's not going to start in the Lebanese camps. It's going to, the Lebanese, the right. arrival of refugees from Syria has made the Lebanese camps a catastrophic situation. Yeah. The population of these camps is just increased by 100% maybe, or 50% in some cases, by the arrival of probably 100,000 people from Syria who are destitute and who immediately go to their relatives or the people they know or people from the same village in the Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon. So it's not going to start in Lebanon. It's not going to start in Jordan.
Right.
Jordan's too well policed.
Right.
It'll start in the occupied territories, in the camps in the West Bank and maybe Gaza. And there you have a simmering discontent. In the villages, you have simmering discontent. I'm not saying that's going to erupt. Something may happen, something may not happen. The security cooperation between the PA, between Israel, is such that it's going to be very hard for certain kinds of things to happen. On the other hand, you never know. There was the same security cooperation in at the time of the Second Intifada. And the Second Intifada turned into, I think it was a catastrophic disaster for the Palestinians, but it was unmanageable, uncontrollable by any leadership for the better part of 2 years. So I think it will be some shock that might lead to the possibility of a change. It may be the failure of this negotiating process. I don't know. I hate to predict. I mean, you're a political scientist.
Right.
You try and think about how things are changing and where they might go. As a citizen, as a political analyst, you know, as a human being, I like to think about those things. But I don't like to predict. I you know, look back at history. Nobody saw the 1870 commune. Nobody saw that coming.
Right.
Things just happen.
And then we
historians with hindsight can go back and analyze why.
Right. Okay, Rashid, thank you very much for your time. I enjoyed the conversation.
Pleasure, Nadia.
Thanks, take care.
Thank you.
That was Columbia University historian Rashid Khalidi in conversation with Nader Hashemi of the University of Denver. That is it for this week. Thanks for listening to This Week in Palestine. We're here every Sunday morning, so join us again next week and every week. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.